Hi, this is Elizabeth Lynch of ChinaLawAndPolicy.com. Welcome to our podcast. Today we will be discussing the American Clean Energy and Security Act of 2009, or what is sometimes known as the Climate Change Bill or the Waxman-Markey Bill. Before Congress went to recess for the summer, the House of Representatives passed by a very thin margin the Climate Change Bill. Now it awaits discussion before the Senate when the Senate returns after Labor Day. There is high likelihood that the Senate will change some of the House bill since heated debate and negotiation is anticipated. A key piece of the bill that will be heavily discussed in the Senate is the border adjustment measure sections, or what is more commonly referred to as tariffs. In order to pass the bill, the House threw in two provisions to help protect certain U.S. manufacturing industries that may face foreign competitors not subject to similar emissions regulation. Joining us today to discuss these tariff provisions is Jake Cadwell, Director of Policy for Agriculture, Trade, and Energy at the Center for American Progress. Thank you for joining us, Jake.
My pleasure, Elizabeth.
First, can you give us some background on the tariff provisions in the climate change bill?
Right. Well, over in the House of the U.S. Congress, the House of Representatives, they've produced a fairly complex response to the issue of both competitiveness and something called carbon leakage, where the issue there is the movement or migration of carbon, carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas, but also jobs to overseas competitors, countries that perhaps are not taking the same amount of action as the United States. This is a little bit ironic in that the United States has probably not taken as much action as some other countries around the world, but needless to say, it is in the House bill. A couple of the details on what the House provided. Number one, they said for energy-intensive, trade-sensitive industries, and here we're talking about steel, cement, chemicals, they will be given a two-year waiver from being obligated to fall under the cap and trade mechanism that will be established under the House bill. So two-year moratorium for them, for energy-intensive, trade-sensitive. The second provision allows for these same industries to receive emissions allowances that will compensate them for the cost of compliance. Once the 2 years is over and they have to comply with the cap and trade program, they will be given allowances to help them comply. And the third piece that's garnered quite a bit of attention is this international border adjustment provision, which essentially requires the President of the United States to require our trading partners that are importing these goods into the United States to submit emissions allowances along the same lines as the United States industries if, by 2018, there is no international agreement. And the President can do this by 2020. And the interesting thing about this provision is that by 2020, the President has to make a decision on whether to impose this emissions allowance requirement, which can be seen as a tariff, basically, on foreign imports on these products. The President has to make a decision. He can grant, or she can grant, a waiver to those countries, but the waiver has to also be backed up by a joint resolution of Congress. So the default is towards the tariffs.
Okay. So just to clarify, so with the border adjustment measures, that will only occur if there isn't an agreement reached, a multilateral agreement reached at Copenhagen in December?
The actual provision is that if there's no international agreement by 2018, then these border adjustment measures will kick in. So it's possible we might not have an agreement in Copenhagen, but if as long as there's an agreement by 2018, we may avoid these border adjustment measures.
Okay. And in terms of measuring other countries' emissions, does the bill say anything at all about how to measure it, especially with a country like China where a lot of people question the validity of their measurements?
Yeah, I think that's a huge outlying question in terms of, even in the United States, I mean, what they've said is that they're going to talk about sector-specific industries, so they have to be energy-intensive and they have to be sensitive to trade. They can't just be any industry that uses a lot of energy. They have to be actually active in international markets. But given that, and then they're going to measure both their energy intensity and their greenhouse gases that they emit and their outputs, that alone in the United States and getting that proper data is going to be very difficult to do. So how that will occur on an international level remains a very big open question.
Okay, and in terms of the House putting these provisions into the bill, were the reasons precisely to protect industries in the United States. How did these provisions get into the bill? Were they initially part of the House bill, or were they thrown in at the end?
Well, the provisions in the House bill, and this is a caution for your listeners and viewers of your blog, is that be wary of policy that professes to sort of have many purposes. And I think this, in particular, these border adjustment measures fit into that category in terms of they were, A, designed to go after this carbon leakage issue, which I talked about, which was sort of the migration of carbon to other countries if the U.S. were taking action, but also the migration of jobs to those countries if they felt that they could gain an advantage from not being under the similar environmental regulation or climate change regulation. And that goes to the second argument, which is competitiveness. Is the U.S. potentially at a competitive disadvantage if it's actually taking action towards climate change? A big if there. And other countries are not. And the third argument that's put forth for the border adjustment measures is leverage over developing countries to get them to accede to an international agreement, to bring them to the table to participate in an international agreement. Unspoken was certainly a focus on China and to some extent India, but primarily China.
And will these provisions, I mean, it seems like just on the face of it, not knowing more behind it, that the provisions will in fact protect U.S. industries, assuming that a country like China or a country like India doesn't have similar emission caps. But is that actually true?
I think the potential is there for this to knock out incentives, perhaps, for an industry, energy-intensive, trade-sensitive industry to move to a country with laxer environmental regulation or climate change regulation. This potentially cuts off that route for them. But I think in the history of and in the economics of looking at why industries locate where they do, I'm not sure environmental regulation stands up to be the main reason for the migration of industries. I think it's much more around technology, much more around education of the workforce, much more around labor costs. So potentially it will cut off a certain route of some companies that may have been thinking about laxer carbon regulation in a carbon-constrained world that we have. But we're not going to solve the competitiveness problem by just simply going after this component of it. It has to be a much broader strategy than that.
Okay. And what will happen if the climate change bill, because it's before the Senate, if it is passed with these provisions? Well, how will the rest of the world react, you think, and how will this impact the U.S. in going into Copenhagen?
I think you're initially going to see some fairly negative reaction from the rest of the world. We've seen a bit of this already. China has objected fairly vociferously. India in particular, with Secretary Clinton's trip to India just last month, spoke and addressed this issue of carbon tariffs directly and said that they were really unacceptable, and I think the word used was pernicious. So you're going to have, at least on the surface, a visceral negative reaction. In terms of how it plays in Copenhagen, it's really going to be unclear. I think there'll initially be a negative reaction to, oh, here comes the United States again, acting holier than thou, with a provision that is actually going to be more addressed at competitiveness than really at the climate change problem, or that will be at least the accusation. But whether that may actually provide a bit of an incentive, I mean, certainly these border tariff measures gain the attention of countries and governments, and as we've seen from China and India. And certainly we've seen actually recently with the South Korea announcement that they're going to take international action, that they too cited the border tariffs as a reason to jump on board with an international agreement. So we may see sort of on the surface a negative reaction, but then maybe below the surface actual momentum towards an international agreement.
So do you think then that these provisions could in fact have the leverage that might have been intended to bring, because China and India seem pretty adamant, at least as of late, that they're not interested in capping greenhouse emissions?
I think there's an opportunity that if we can actually even work with China and India and the developed nations like the European Union and actually well all the nations in terms of an international agreement, if we can work in a way to craft these border adjustment measures so that they don't discriminate between domestic products and foreign products, and perhaps agree on a framework to putting them into place and into force, then I think there's actually a possibility that they could provide some momentum towards an international agreement. So yeah, they could work.
Mm-hmm. And Are there other ways outside of having tariff provisions in this climate change bill? Because, in some ways you don't want other countries to be able to benefit if, for some reason, China or India don't agree to have cap and trade. But are there other ways, either through the treaty at Copenhagen or through other bodies such as the WTO, where we can guarantee that U.S. business won't be adversely affected?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, I should say that if they can be properly constructed, they may provide some leverage. I do want to emphasize that it's my personal feeling that we need to use them with a real abundance of caution, that they are potentially very dangerous from a trade war situation, from a tit-for-tat trade penalty, and even that word protectionism standpoint in terms of countries taking action. Are there other things we can do? Yes, certainly a multilateral agreement, an international agreement, starting in Copenhagen but moving on from there is the best way to go, whether it's on agreeing on ways to attack carbon issues at the border or even on basically carbon dioxide and greenhouse gas targets. The other forum for this is basically the WTO. You could do that. That is possible. The WTO has shown a much more greater sensitivity to environmental issues in the recent past. And the only concern I have there is that the WTO is a very, very slow process, as we've seen with the Doha round negotiations launched in 2001 and still sort of lurching along. So I wouldn't want to leave it up to the WTO, which might be a very long process. So my preference would be for the Copenhagen UN Framework Convention process. The third way is in the United States and other countries is sort of the first part of the provision in the House bill, which is to use domestic allowances or domestic incentives to actually help these industries, that if they do have a legitimate case to be made, that they are energy intense, and that they do have sensitivity on trade, on exports and imports, then we should be stepping up to the plate and helping them with assistance from our own U.S. government and not taking it out on foreign competitors.
Okay, and that would be the carbon leakage provisions?
That would be the carbon leakage provisions, but also just allowing them to have allowances to a certain level that would be free and that would allow them to meet the costs of compliance of some of the domestic regulation.
So in going back to where we stand now with the bill, once the Senate's back in session after Labor Day, how do you see things shaping up? I know that initially some senators were against the tariff provisions, but more recently other senators have come out, especially senators from states where there's high industry that would be impacted. How do you see things shaping up in the Senate going forward in the next few months?
Well, it's going to be really interesting, Elizabeth, because essentially the Senate is traditionally in the United States considered the more trade-friendly, more liberalized trade-friendly body, and I think that is still largely true. Initially, when these provisions came out of the House, there was some concern from Senator Boxer, Senator Kerry, Senator Baucus, real leaders on the climate change issue and on trade issues, about these provisions. What we've seen now, though, is that the pressure mounts on the swing votes, the senators from the Midwest, senators like Senator Bayh, Senator Sherry Brown from Ohio. They are suggesting that these provisions actually are a necessity in the Senate bill. And I think that's where we've started to head. I think you'll see essentially these provisions be either very close to the House provisions on the Senate side, and perhaps even a bit stronger. But what I'm hopeful of is that the Senate will take a good look at the House provisions and make them better, if you will, make them more WTO compliant, or better I would define as improve in terms of making more WTO compliant, so less, no discrimination between domestic and international products, but also perhaps taking a look at the enforcement of these issues on a sector-by-sector basis, so that if there is a violation of one industry in a particular country, in China, let's say the steel industry feels like it's believed to be falling behind on its carbon emissions, we don't take it all out on all Chinese imports, for instance. So I think the Senate will narrow the scope of this provision down to specific sectors. The other thing I'm hoping the Senate will do is actually provide a great deal more deference towards the President, because in the United States, even though the Constitution provides for the Congress to have role in treaties and foreign affairs. We like to speak with one voice from the White House, and so the president should be the ultimate person making the decision on whether to impose these border adjustment measures or not. And hopefully that's something the Senate will do.
So right now, as the tariff provisions stand, the border adjustment provisions stand, it isn't on a sector-by-sector basis. So if China's steel industry, all of China's imports will then be subject to something.
Yeah, it's a little unclear, but I guess theoretically, if we got all the way to 2020 and there was still no international agreement, and then we're probably all in trouble, but if there were no international agreement by 2020 and these provisions started to be put in force by the United States, that would be, you could see that it may potentially have the effect on all imports from China. It's just not clear how it will be enforced. So one way of potentially narrowing the scope is to say, well, look, maybe the aluminum industry in China is in compliance, but the cement industry is not. Maybe we can just talk about getting to work on the cement industry, and maybe we can work in partnership to get the cement industry into compliance instead of sort of using a stick all the time in terms of border adjustment measures.
And in terms of deference toward the president, would that mean that in the provision, as it stands now, there's that portion where Congress has to, ratify?
Yeah, it's interesting.
Is that what you would want to come out?
Well, this is an interesting piece of U.S. law. It's not clear to me how constitutional it is, but essentially the president has the right to grant a waiver to a China, let's say, if he feels like, or she feels like they're not in compliance. But then that has to be seconded, if you will, by Congress through a joint resolution. I think it might be preferable to just have the president make that decision all on their own and not need the sanction of Congress.
Okay. And in questioning the constitutionality of the provision as it stands now, is that because Congress would be overstepping its bound and stepping into the executive power?
I need to go back to school a little bit on it, but it rang an alarm bell for me, in terms of actually granting the president a power to grant a waiver on this, and then taking it away from him or her by requiring a joint resolution.
Okay. And how do you think things are looking in passing the climate change bill before the Senate, just in general, right now?
I think things are going to be very, very close. I think it's come down to a few of these swing senators, mostly from the Midwest, and that's why the border adjustment provision is getting a lot of attention. But I think my advice to the U.S. Senate is actually to ratchet up the chances of us achieving an international agreement. So they should be putting more money into international technology transfer, international cooperation, adaptation, and less emphasis on some of the border adjustment measures.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Jake. I think this gives us a good background on what's going to be happening in September and October before the Senate.
My thanks, Elizabeth.